We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for Focus is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this morning, Jason Croft. Today we open the phone lines for questions about computers. This is a topic we take up once a month on the first Thursday of the month. Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick of CITES join us this month. CITES, the acronym for the University of Illinois' Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services. Jim is a wireless network designer at CITES. Debbie is a network engineer at CITES. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Jim, Debbie, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
And we already have a caller ready to go, so let's go and take this call. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Yeah, we're going to do the easy ones first.
Okay.
Easy question. If any of them used, I'm still in the process of buying a computer and all that, and I was thinking maybe getting a smaller one and then running it through my TV, you know, I get a DVD. Has anyone done that, or, I mean, is there ups and downs of that, or any comment?
Well, first, do you want to run it through your TV to watch movies and things like that, or you want to use the TV for your main computer screen?
Well, I was thinking of that. You know, because if I got a small, you know, the book thing or whatever it is, and a small screen, but would there be any downside?
Well, it depends on how big your TV is.
It's pretty good size.
Okay, so in our office, we have a pretty large screen. It's actually a TV that we use to put up maps for monitoring things, you know, stuff you look at across the room from a glance. Occasionally, I sit down at that computer to actually do something.
Okay.
And it's really hard. The screen is just so huge that interactive is not easy. If you had a smaller TV screen or it was just occasionally, that would probably be okay, but you wouldn't want that to be your main monitor, typically.
Okay. No harm, that kind of thing. There wouldn't be such a thing with that.
Well, it doesn't hurt anything. It's just you'd probably find it hard to use unless you were sitting quite a ways away.
Yeah, you'd be sitting away on the other side.
Although we have seen TVs be more susceptible to screen burn than dedicated computer LCD monitors.
Yeah, but I guess that was the issue, you know, that kind. The other one is that, this is a minor one, internally, the flash drives, those old sticks, is that what they call those? You know, for the storage?
Flash drives, thumb drives.
Okay, so what's happened is I've had one that I've used for a while, and I don't know, initially I bent it for some reason, you know, and got it straightened. But I have a brand new one. What am I doing wrong? That, you know, now is there a characteristic where you get a little slant to them eventually, or is that the process? Or am I just trying to push too hard? I don't know. You understand? In other words, when I put in that drive, that connection, you know, it's starting to bend a little bit.
A quality drive shouldn't bend.
Okay.
So if you didn't pay much money for it, that might be what you're reaping. Otherwise, I would be concerned that you're pushing too hard. I actually had a netbook with a bad USB port. That you pushed really hard into it, and when I finally did push hard enough to actually make something seat, it fried part of the USB controller. I had to send it in and get it fixed.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks for the call this morning. Others are invited. Join us this morning on Focus with a phone call or by email, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, here at the outset, we don't have anyone waiting now at the moment, so is there anything we should address here while we're waiting for the next person to join us on the phone?
Neither one of us prepared for anything.
Okay. We've had so many questions lately that we hadn't needed anything.
It's true. Well, I'll bring something up. Okay, in the news recently, We saw a security breach at a company that provides marketing services to other companies, and the information obtained included customer names and email addresses. Something to watch for here? Can you fill us in on what we might keep an eye out for?
Phishing.
Sure. Names and email addresses give you, you know, right, exactly. Phishing, the where people try to get you to reveal other information to them through emails. I mean, there'll be a directed email and then maybe a web link, and they'll say, oh, you need to enter your password, something like that, or call us and we need to change stuff. But in general, I suspect that most people are getting that information all the time through other spam stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I do business with at least three of the companies that did business with the company that was breached, because I already received my emails that said, by the way, we'd like to let you know that this happened. I read it and said, okay, they got my email address, and they have my – and I'm not even sure it was full name. Some of them said that maybe only first name. But even if it was full name, I'm like, I'm not worried.
Yeah.
It'll just look like more spam and phishing email to me, and I'll just tell my email program to categorize it as spam and move on.
Yeah. It was interesting. I was notified that my name and email address may have been among those obtained in this incident. And then this company told me how to recognize its emails and said it was actually adding another piece of information to increase security. So hopefully the companies that were hit by this will also get a little tougher in terms of not only protecting themselves from another incident like this, but also adding further security for its customers, people like me.
Yeah, I think one of the important things is, Jim, you didn't say, for people who are not familiar with phishing, if you've missed it, you know, you get an email that's trying to get you to give something away, like you said, no reputable company wants you to type in your account number or your password back to them in an email. In anything you get that says, provide your credit card or account information here of any kind, don't do it. Go find your credit card or whatever and call the customer service number on the back if you think it might be real. But you go call them. Never, ever send your password or your account information back in email, because then suddenly they do have something if it wasn't legit.
Right. And the same thing would be if they say, call me, and they list a phone number to call. Don't. If it says it's from one of your credit card companies, pull out your credit card, look on the back, and see what the customer service number says.
And if it doesn't match, don't call the one in the email.
Also, don't leave that page and go to a link provided by that phishing
Absolutely.
Email.
Yeah, don't click on something from the phishing email.
That's right. If you want to go to your bank's credit card webpage, then go to bring up a new web browser window tab and type in your company's webpage address and go to that way. Don't follow links. Often you'll see that a lot of email programs, you can put your cursor over a link and it'll show you what the actual web address is that it's going to go to. And quite often they don't match. So the link in the email, it looks like it's Chase.com or whatever your popular credit card company is. But when you actually look at the URL that the email link goes to, it's something .ru. Or some foreign countries, not .com, not .net.
Okay. We've got some listeners now ready to talk with us, so let's go and take a call from a listener in Lovington on line one. Hi.
Good morning. I've got an older computer, and I've got 1 gig of RAM in it, which is as much as I can get in it. How much higher do I need to go so that I can watch videos of any kind, news or anything else? Or would that help?
Ed, we really need to know more about the machine. The another big one would be your overall processor speed that you have. So you have a central processing unit, a Pentium or something, or an AMD chip is what generation of...
It's an AMD, and it's about 7 or 8 years old.
You may be able to go and watch some videos, but I think a lot of websites are going to assume that you have a machine newer than that with more horsepower.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line two. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes. Hello. I have an iPod Touch that I carry with me everywhere. And most recently, I discovered a new app that is called Text Free. And so with my iPod, I can use it to text. And then there's also with this application, with a microphone I can place telephone calls. Doesn't that seem too good to be true? Because it really costs me nothing other than, obviously, the Internet connection. And if there's stuff like that, what else is there out there?
Well, they're making money somehow. So that's the question, and I don't know that we're going to have time to investigate exactly what their funding model is.
Well, it's not ad-free. You can pay for it. And this is a free application, but you can pay for it and get ad-free. So maybe.
Oh, so you have ads. You're being displayed ads while you're using the application.
Right. Yes.
So that's their funding model. So it's quite possible that – so basically it's not free. It's using your time to see somebody else's advertisement. You're just not paying.
I'm okay with that. Frankly,
sure.
If I can use it as a – no kidding. I mean, I can use it as a phone, which to me is just crazy. And then all the Internet I want, you know, for all intents and purposes. I'm kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop because it just seems too good to be true. But anyway, if there's that need of an app out there, I wonder what else is out there and where I could find them.
Search engine and the search engine for the iTunes the store, the Apple store.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'd do that. The only reason I found out about this one was, which is obviously available in the App Store, but so there was a column or something that mentioned it. I just wondered if there were others out there that, you know, don't just pop up on the search for the App Store. But isn't that pretty neat?
Sure. I have an unlimited text package on my phone, so I don't have to use an app for that. Regarding finding other apps, there are a couple places. I typed in iPhone apps of the week.
That's a great
and
one.
There's at least one webpage that I subscribe to. That's gizmodo.com. That once a week they publish this week's 10 best iPhone apps.
Really? It's modo.com?
Gizmodo, G-I-Z.
Oh, Gizmodo. Oh.
G-I-Z-M-O-D-O.com. And they have a thing, like I said, weekly that's called This Week's 10 Best iPhone Apps.
Right. Exactly the information I was looking for. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? This is I have a question. I have a laptop, Toshiba laptop. When you type on those keys, it seems like some keys just go flat. They don't... you know, they're able to type with it. You have to push it really hard or sometimes twice. So I'm just kind of wondering what could be the problem for that keyboard.
It could be dirty. So you might just try to get a little bit of canned air.
Okay.
And blow stuff out from under it. The other possibility is that the actual contacts that the keys make, so when you push down a key, there's a little membrane or an electronic switch underneath the key that has to make contact. Eventually, those will wear out. Normally, it's not within the lifetime of, or what we would consider the lifetime of the laptop.
Okay.
But if you're using a laptop past 4 to 5 years and you're a heavy typer or that key gets used a lot, it may actually end up getting worn out.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the replacement is probably to replace the entire key panel system.
Okay.
I mean, you'd have to go to a qualified laptop technician.
Do it.
To have that done, but they would probably have to replace there's usually the keyboard in a laptop, you can take pieces of it out, and the keyboard's one unit, and they probably actually have to replace that entire unit. So depending on the age of the laptop, it may not even be worth the while.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
And next we talk with an Urbana listener on line 1. Hi.
Hello. Main question I've got is more of a trivia question. I recently bought a new SATA hard drive for one of my computers. Now, I use Macs, so when I put it in the machine, it wanted me to zero out all the data. Now, this brought up a question between a friend of mine who is based on PCs. He says that when he gets a new hard drive, he basically just plugs it in and it's ready to go. It doesn't have to do any reformatting, zeroing of data or anything like that. And I'm just kind of curious, do blank hard drives, if you go out to Newegg or some company like that and buy a blank hard drive, is it pre-formatted for Windows and so the Mac people have to basically reformat it?
It depends. In general, often Mac people will have to reformat it if you want it to be in the Mac OS journaled file system. I think that's what's...
Right. And beyond that, there's two or three different formats for Windows these days, and Mac can read some of them, like FAT32, but it can't read some of the newer ones.
So a PC person, depending on how their system is set up, might have to reformat, but not always?
It may, an internal drive may actually come completely just blank. So a drive that you put in the machine. External hard drives almost all come in either NTFS, which is the newest Windows file system, or in FAT32, which is a file system that almost every operating system can read. The newest versions, I believe it may not come automatically enabled, but I believe that 10.6 OS X can actually read NTFS, but you actually have to go turn on that ability. But certainly Mac people are almost always going to have to format their stuff. Now, that doesn't mean it's not a bad idea for a Windows person to do the same thing anyway. Quite often I've seen external hard drives, and they have a little extra partition on them that has some backup, free backup utility or some other utilities that came with the external drive. And it's, you know, that's using space that you could use. It's not much usually. But a lot of times for me, I get a new external drive. First thing I do is wipe out all the partitions and reformat the whole drive.
I generally do that, too. This is more, like I said, it's a trivia. It's kind of, we had never really tried it, so we hadn't gotten any background. The other thing is the guy who had the laptop with the bad keyboard, if the cleaning doesn't work and he doesn't want to repair it, he can possibly go out and buy another USB keyboard and plug it in and use that. I've found that I've been able to do that on occasion. But then that changes the nature of the computer, so... Well, it's a double-edged sword.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the idea, too, for the earlier caller. Another call coming in now on line 4, Morton, Illinois. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I've got a Mac G4, an iBook, and when I call up... news sites such as our local papers and things of that sort, it just seems like it's getting slower and slower and slower. I keep getting things that say I need to update my website or my browser or my JavaScript and things of those sort are out of date. Problem is the system I have, which is the OS X, is 10.3.9, is not supported by a lot of the new JavaScripts and web browsers. Am I just relegated to spending the $400 plus to buy a new OS X or extra money to buy a new computer? And I'll listen off mine.
Well, I'd say first, last time I checked OS X prices, a non-educational price was around $100 for a license. I'll try and double check that real quick here. But the first thing I'd say is it's not your computer, it's the websites. Places like News Gazette and some of the other sites have gone very heavily flash. Things are embedded in other things. Some of that's so you can't steal images. Some of that's just because they want to give the what they feel is the best user experience, the most modern user experience, I think would be my definition, not necessarily the best, because I have trouble reading some of those things too. I would see... about upgrading to OS 10.5. 10.6 doesn't support G4. And a box set on Amazon for OS 10.5.6, which would then patch to 10.5.8. It says 13 used and new from $157. So that's more than I was thinking, but it's certainly not $400. And so that might be an option. But yes, at 10.3, among other things, you're far enough behind the curve you won't be getting patches. Neither 10.3 or 10.4 is patched for security flaws at this point, so you really do want to be running 10.5 if you're surfing the internet anyway, or you're much more vulnerable to security issues in your software. Hopefully that helps a little bit.
Okay. And let's take another call, or did you want to say something, Jeff?
No, that's
okay.
Max and Debbie.
All right. We're getting some Mac questions today. I'm so happy because last month we were a little... We had lots of PC questions and not very many Mac questions. Okay, let's take another call. This is Urbana, line 1. Hi, you're on Focus.
Hello?
Hi there.
Yes. Is that me?
It is. Go ahead. What can we help you with?
I have been using the McAfee site agent, Site Advisor, and it works just fine on the one computer. My laptop, it seems to install correctly, but the green or colored flags, depending on the status of the site that I'm thinking of, the URL I'm thinking of going to, don't show up. And I'm wondering, there is a way that it will work without that. It just warns you when you get to a dangerous site. But I have no indication that that's the way it's working. Is there something else I could use with similar functionality that you could advise?
I'm not actually familiar with very many of those tools at all. I don't personally use Site Advisors except for what's built into the browsers I use.
Well, I'm using Firefox, and that supposedly has security built in.
Right, and every once in a while it comes up and tells me, warning, you probably don't want to go here.
I have had that happen.
Sure. Regarding the functionality of the McAfee on your laptop, I'm wondering if you have any other firewalls, specifically like application-level firewalls installed that are preventing that particular program from actually accessing the Internet so that it can find out whether it should greenlight the URL that you're looking at. So I would start with possibly uninstalling it and installing it again and see if any of your firewalls, because I don't know if you're using the Windows one or if you're using some other one that came with an antivirus package.
Well, I'm using McAfee for a virus scan, and I'm using the Windows firewall, but I'm using it on both computers.
Okay, but the settings could be different. And you know that the McAfee firewall is not installed?
Pardon?
Are you positive that the McAfee firewall is not installed?
Yes, I've never had it.
Okay. Then you might try to find what the executable is, the name of the actual program for that toolbar, the McAfee site safety toolbar, lack of a better name, and then go into the Windows firewall and add that executable as allowed and see if that makes any difference.
Actually, you meant not the McAfee firewall, but the McAfee Site Advisor.
Right, the Site Advisor. Find the executable of the McAfee Site Advisor, the actual name of that program, and add that to the Windows firewall, to the allowed applications list.
That makes sense, yes. I actually tried to uninstall the McAfee Site Advisor and found that I had difficulty in doing that, which makes me wonder about it.
Right. If you had problems uninstalling it, then probably the best place to go is to McAfee's support site and start with getting rid of that program and then trying to put it in again. Because maybe it's not functioning correctly is because there's some part of it that's not installed correctly, which is also the reason why you can uninstall it.
You feel that the, obviously, you feel that the Firefox security software is probably adequate.
Well, for me it is. I'm very careful about what links I click on.
Well,
I know what, in my opinion, what a properly formed URL for a safe website should look like in general. When I'm going to go to a URL for some reason that's not part of a Google search result, it's in an email or something, when I look at it, I kind of know to look that say, oh, this is trying to trick me into going to somewhere I didn't think we were going, kind of stuff. So and for me, I feel that the stuff built into Firefox and Internet Explorer are adequate. I think that's up for the user to make a decision for themselves.
It sounds as though, if anything, I'm even a little more careful than you because I just don't go to something in an email unless I absolutely know what it is.
Sure. So then, in my opinion, if in that case, then you probably don't need the additional Site Advisor.
Well, that's probably better then because everything you load in is going to slow the computer slightly. So the less you're using, as long as you have the protection you need, really the better.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. Today we have the phone lines open for questions about computers. We can also take email messages. This is a topic we take up once a month on the first Thursday of the month. Whether you're looking for a new computer, have questions about online security, or need some troubleshooting advice, our guests are happy to help. Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick are with us this morning. They're with Sites. That is the acronym for the University of Illinois' Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services. Jim is a wireless network designer. Debbie is a network engineer. Again, my name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call, 333-9455. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, that's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. So the reason to disable McAfee Site Advisor would be just to give your computer a little boost.
Well, for me, it's just a superfluous program.
Oh, okay.
And I try to not run. I can't stand toolbars at the top of my the smaller I can make the toolbar at the top of my browser,
yeah,
the happier I am. So I don't like extra stuff, so any other programs that are up there just are taking, as far as I'm concerned, they're stealing screen real estate from me.
Really? Okay. Stealing screen real estate. See, I like them. For me, they're very handy in here in the studio because I can, boom, just go very quickly to this, that, or the other thing. How do you manage?
Depends. Well, I mean, I do have, like, for instance, on
your
this
favorites,
one, on
bookmarks?
This one, I have tabs open and I have bookmarks open,
uh-huh,
and that's
okay.
It. So,
all right.
I don't know what Debbie's preference is, but I like having more, being able to see more of the web page and less of toolbars.
Okay, and I've also thought that McAfee Site Advisor was useful if you were doing a browser search, and that little, you know, OK came up from McAfee for the various sites. And, you know, it can be an aid.
And again, it can. And that's,
yeah,
that's where I was getting at, is that for specific users, I think it's something that each user needs to decide for themselves whether they require that or not. I personally don't,
okay,
feel that I need to. And so far, so good.
Okay. To each his own.
Maybe I'm living dangerously.
I doubt it. You know, you guys are the experts. So let's take another call. This is a listener in Central Illinois on line one. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for the program. How is my voice? Is it too loud?
You're fine. You're coming in great.
Thank you. I have a question about QR codes. And what I'd like a developer to do for me is possibly develop one so that I can set up like a PayPal, so a pay system. So that's the first question. And then second question would be, what are your opinions on QR codes exploding in the United States specifically, as they've been mostly in Europe and in Asia, really heavily used, and now just starting to hit the U.S.?
They're handy.
Those are my two questions.
Yeah, I don't know about if you're talking offline or online. Let's start with the first one where you're talking about, like, you wanted your own QR code to point to, for instance, a PayPal site.
Yeah.
I think that's relatively easy. I just typed in QR codes in Google, and I found a website called the QR Code Generator.
Oh, okay.
And the content it asked me, which is a URL, so then you could point that to your PayPal shopping cart site or whatever you have.
That's interesting. Okay.
And it also lets you pick whether it's text, a phone number, or SMS. So, and then you can pick how big it is and hit generate. So it looks like it's fairly simple, and some web pages have it. I just created a QR code that says if I clicked on it, it'll go to google.com. So, and it looks like I can save that image and print it out if you wanted it offline. So I think that part's easy.
Okay.
And then regarding their explosion in the United States, I don't have an opinion on that much. I have found them very handy. The most useful thing I have found for them is actually regarding getting software onto my mobile phone. I have an Android device,
uh-huh,
and when I'm on some web page and there's it's talking about, well, download this program or this, you know, this I made, you know, this again earlier we were talking about the 10 best iPhone apps of the week. Well, there's also the 10 best Android apps for the week. And you're looking at one of those and you go to the developer's webpage and it says this is what it does, and it says, by the way, if you point your phone's web barcode scanner at this QR code, which is happens to be on my monitor, it's not printed or anything, it'll take you straight to the market and you don't have to search for it. I have found that very useful. I think that's a really cool way to move data from, or to get a like a URL or something from your computer to your mobile device. The rest of the question I think is more of a something for somebody that's in marketing. I've heard of the reasons to have QR codes. You know, you can have them on the front of your store, and it it generates a coupon for the person, or it, they can see this week's specials in a URL.
I've seen them on posters at poster sessions here at the university. You know, if you so if you want to get more information, a lot of the QR readers will queue up those URLs, so then you can go back and look at them later. And then I used it myself. A month or so ago, I was doing some comparison shopping of all things color inkjets and microwaves, you know, stuff I was thinking about replacing. And I was at Best Buy, and you know, Best Buy shows you their, you know, their little tiny little card of what features this thing has, and you could QR code it in, and pull up, you know, more detail. Now it was still in Best Buy's list, so it didn't suddenly get me generic comparisons, but it turned out to be handy, and you could get just a little bit more detail, and also went back and reviewed them later. And which one did I like more? Now that I'm at home, there I've got the model number right there with me. I didn't have to write it down. Things like that.
Handy, very handy. Right. So then, are the undergraduates at U of I using QR codes? Are they designing projects? Are professors teaching it yet?
Well, I mean, it's just a barcode.
Yeah. Well, that's easy for you guys, but, you know, I am a little bit challenged technically, but I, you know, I understand it very well conceptually, but, you know, I think I would find it very time consuming, but I'll trust you. I'll trust you. I'm going to try it.
Well, you know, from the webpage I found, which I just created one that would take a mobile phone to the WILL webpage, that's easy to generate that information. So the difficult part is the marketing business side of this is finding uses for these things and how to get people to actually click on them or scan them in, let's say, through their mobile device. So, just go to Google and type in one word QR codes, and I think it was the second or third link is a free it's a QR code generator, and I started using it for the first time while we were talking on the phone here. So now you can also do cute things where you can embed images into them because of the QR code. Its error correction allows you to mess it up a little bit, and you can put a logo in the middle of it and stuff. This webpage does not do that for you, and that's beyond the technical scope of what I can help you with today.
Yeah, and we work in the IT groups. We're not teaching or you know, working with students on a regular basis, so I couldn't tell you one way or the other how they're teaching. You know, if they're teaching how to use computers, they might well include something like that these days. And if they're teaching marketing, they might do that. But if it were just in your English class or something like that, I don't think it would come up.
Okay. Well, I want to thank the listener for her call. And next we're going to take a call from a listener in Champaign on line 2. Hi.
Hi, I'm glad to hear that you guys are with Sites, because I have a question that kind of relates to one of the services you offer. Let me say that my wife is a graduate student with the university, and a few weeks ago she got some kind of virus somehow on her computer, and it was actually a kind where it, I think through trying to execute multiple processes, you couldn't even move the mouse on the thing. So I was also a university student. I've graduated, and I was aware that Sites offers something I believe you call a rescue disk that is a standalone executable CD that with your NetID you can access, download, and burn, and then put into the computer, and it will actually boot itself up from the CD and then scan your hard drive. And I hadn't had to use it for a while. When I last used it, I noticed that you guys now had a Linux boot system, which I really liked, because most viruses are skewed to try to avoid things under Windows. And by going through Linux, I think you avoid some of that. So I really liked that. But she's graduating in May. And I was wondering, for the future, we're not going to have access to that. Is there anything comparable to that for us and any listeners who aren't connected with the university, that if they need to have something that boots on its own and scans, that maybe is available?
Almost all the antivirus companies push out, well, a rescue disk of some sort. If you go to a search engine and just type in rescue disk, you're going to get a lot of answers. There's also some what I would call community-developed rescue CDs, rescue DVDs that have a lot of the, they'll have a lot of different utilities and free antivirus scanners and other things on them. So, yeah, there's a lot of rescue disk stuff out there for the public to use. I think the Sites one, which Debbie and I are both in Sites Networking, I believe that the Rescue Disk is a collaboration between the Help Desk and the Security Group.
I believe that's correct.
I believe it includes some of the licensed utilities that the university pays for. So you're not going to run into stuff like that free off the internet. But there are certainly other tools out there. And if you do purchase a antivirus product, then that company, a lot of times those companies will have something you can create when you first install it that creates a rescue disk. And sometimes those are actually tuned specifically to your system, and they save information off your system to make it easier to recover if there is a problem.
Do you know if any of those products available online use Linux as a boot device? Because I was thinking, but maybe you guys just did that so it would be more cross-platform available for students if they have a Mac or a PC. But I was thinking that it's easier for something running on Linux to detect a virus that's tailor-made for Windows.
Well, when you boot off a CD, you're not going to be able to infect the CD. So in general, the media that's in the hard drive of the computer that you're scanning is almost considered like offline media. You're not executing things off of that drive. So in general, I don't know that there's a big help in changing operating systems when you're scanning an offline drive, or it's online, but you're not actually running the operating system off of it. So I'm not sure that's an issue. Part of it is that Windows is a lot of software, and the Windows PE environment, which is the one that you can boot off of CDs, tends to be big. And it sometimes when I've used it, it seems to take an awfully long time to actually be able to boot up into a function, something you can actually use, whereas the Linux Live CDs tend to be pretty quick. And what I consider, I guess, would consider less bloat.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say I think it more depends on what the software that you're using to fix it or take the virus off with and how good that is than which OS you're booting into off the CD.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Next we go to Urbana, line 4. Hi.
Hi, yes. I have a question related to even being able to get on the internet. I have a combined router and wireless hub, the 2-wire, and I have no trouble at all using my Macintosh laptop to get on, or whether it's wireless or using the LAN. However, when I hook up my older Microsoft PC, it stays on for about 2 minutes, and then it bumps off. And I've talked to a network administrator about this. I've looked online in the forums, and we can come up with nothing of why it would only last about 2 minutes, and then it doesn't register. It says that it times out. Do you have any thoughts or suggestions for that?
Which Windows PC operating system are we talking about?
Windows XP.
Okay. Some of the things I would start with is to make sure that your Windows XP device or your computer is actually set up for DHCP and not statically assigned IP address.
Okay.
To make sure that you're not actually colliding with some other device that you have running at the time.
Okay.
And because it's possible that a computer would work fine until all of a sudden it detected that, oh, there's another machine on this LAN that has the same IP address as me. I'm just going to stop functioning until you fix this.
The other.
So this, oh, go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
So the next thing I'd look at if it was set to DHCP is your two-wire router. Excuse me. Has a web interface. And in it, it'll show you all the machines that have ever connected, and it'll show you whether they're currently connected or not connected. Ever is a long time, recently connected, you know, in the past couple of months to it at least, or at the very least since the last time you rebooted it. But you can web in and you can see those machines. If they're live, you can see what IP address they're being given. You can look at what the IP ranges that are being handed out, and you can match that against what your PC said it had and do some comparisons. I'm not sure if that's the kind of stuff you went through with your troubleshooting folks or not?
I have read some things about the possibility of it sharing or, you know, getting confused because of the various different numbers that it was giving in those sections. And I was wondering if that, you know, was a potential fix of trying to, they said that you could reassign a number to it or you could change the range that it was using so that it wouldn't be confused, if that was one of the issues. I had tried a couple things like that and it didn't work, but I didn't go through all of them.
Well, I know for some of our systems we set static IP addresses, and for some of them we don't. But if you are setting a static IP address on the computer, you've got to go into the two-wire and make sure that you're picking one that's not in the range they're assigning out of to other hosts. You can also, inside the two-wire, you can tell it to pick a random address or to give it a specific address. And those would definitely be the kinds of things I would try first. Because it sounds like it's connecting for a little bit and then getting confused, and that's unusual. Usually things either get on or they don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it was perplexing, because I've used it on, you know, other LAN networks before, including at my parents', for example, and never had any trouble. And so, you know, I was just surprised. It lasts about 2 or 3 minutes usually, and then it's over. And it didn't even seem to make much difference if, say, I didn't have my laptop connected or I had the wireless disabled or something like that. It would still be, you know, only a couple of minutes, so... and that's even with I even put a new Ethernet card in. So.
The other, I guess there's a possibility that there's some program or there's some issue with the firewall or something that's causing problems, that the 2 minutes is, if it's an older machine, that it's still booting up processes in the background while you're trying to do stuff.
Okay.
That's a long shot, but it's out there.
Well, thank you for your ideas.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to Edgar County, line one. Hi.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Fine, how are you?
Good, thank you for everything that you guys do with technology. Live in rural Edgar County, Illinois. Analog phone line, dial-up is not an option. I've done a little bit of research on 2 satellite delivery systems for internet access. Is there a website to go to that will cross-compare options for you? Because I can't spend time on the phone with all of these providers, which takes hours. So, Debbie, maybe you're the whiz at this. Maybe you could help me.
Haven't done much with satellite internet.
There's a website out there called dslreports.com, which I don't know if they cover satellite, but their website is broadband ISP reviews, news, tools, and forums. So it's possible that they will cover the satellite ones. I'm not even sure how many different satellite providers there are. I have never researched that.
Apparently 4 major ones.
Okay.
Satellite Internet Compare in Google got me a hit that is comparing the big 4. It lists pricing and then a side-by-side of what their download and upload speeds are, how many email accounts you get, you know, whether they're two-way or one-way, the equipment prices and whether they're lease. So it turned out it took me to the very long URL of www.high-speed-internet-access-guide.com. Uh-huh. So I'd suggest satellite internet compare in Google, and that you should be able to find a couple of pages there that are doing the comparison that I think you're looking for.
Okay, and any suggestion of how to advocate with the national provider of still analog phone line to get them to go? Because if they go digital, then that's encouraging, and within about 7 miles of me, they have put digital in a very isolated rural area, but I just don't know where to advocate as well to get the entire county. I know in Champaign-Urbana there was a big effort a year or so ago advocating for broadband across the county, I believe, which was wonderful.
Well, actually, it was almost entirely in CU proper, and a little bit of Savoy was most of it, but I don't think there is a real good way to convince the carriers to do it. You either get enough people to ask that they think it's worth their money, or you don't.
And rural, I mean, the equipment involved to get – when you're saying digital, I mean, the only digital that the phone companies are going to push across their lines that I'm aware of right now would be DSL in this area. Because there is digital phone, which was ISDN. That's just not going to happen in this country. That's old technology, and it's except for special cases, you don't get that anymore. Analog phone lines with just regular dial-up. And then your next step on a pair of copper from the phone company is DSL. The problem with DSL is that it only can go so much distance from the nearest central office without equipment, active electronic equipment, being put in the middle of a cornfield or, you know, on the side of the road at one of their pedestals.
Right.
And the cost of getting power to one of those pedestals, along with the limited number of customers that will actually be able to utilize that equipment at that location, it just prohibits them, and I don't expect it to happen. I just don't think, unless some sort of subsidy from the government through E-rate or something happens, that the phone companies will ever do that.
Well, you've explained it very well for me, and I do know eventually someday they're talking about internet through the electrical grid, and I know in Houston I believe they started that. But I always enjoy listening. You guys are very informative. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I have one more suggestion. Before you go to satellite, and I don't know what the situation is in Edgar County, is to find wireless ISPs. So I know in some of the other counties where I've had customers, you get grain bins that have wireless. They bring in a T1 connection or use another wireless backhaul link into a radio tower or a tall grain bin. And they'll put Wi-Fi antennas, and you can subscribe to that. That's actually would be my choice before I went to satellite, most if you could get a good quality one. Satellite systems will involve high latency, which is fine when you're doing downloading files, because once it gets started, the file just downloads, and it's very fast. I've had customers on satellite. But if you're doing other things where latency matters, voice over IP possibly, or any other kind of two-way Skype communication stuff, or any kind of gaming at all, you'll want to stay with something that's terrestrial-based wireless. And there's a lot of those. There's a lot of terrestrial-based Wi-Fi ISPs that are filling in the gap where the phone company is not doing that.
The other thing to look at also, if you've got good cellular coverage, is you can buy so many gigabits per month of cellular data download on either a USB thing you stick in your computer or a little more expensive one that does cellular to Wi-Fi. And if you're not looking for lots of data, I think you can get 2 or 5 gigabits a month for a fairly reasonable subscription price, probably as cheaper than the DSL or the satellite prices I was looking at a minute ago.
Okay. This is Focus. It's our monthly show on computers. My name is Celeste Quinn. And a reminder, you can listen to today's Focus and other Focus shows in the archives anytime you'd like. The website is will.illinois.edu, will.illinois.edu. Next caller is in Champaign, line 3. Hi.
Hi. Back to the caller who asked about generic rescue disks. Unfortunately, there aren't any that don't require kind of some savvy knowledge of how to burn an image on your disk. I mean, you can always do that, but I think the easiest for your average home user that I would recommend would be either going to the ESET scanner online or Dr. Web Curate, both of which are available online. And just to let the average user know, there are many websites. There's Bleeping Computer, there's Geeks2Go, MajorGeeks.com, that all have teams of people trained in helping your average user remove malware from their machine. So if people are looking for a resource, they are out there. Sometimes it requires another computer, unfortunately, while your main one's dead. But I just wanted to let the average users know these resources out there for them.
Okay, thanks for the call. Any comments on our listeners' suggestions?
No, and he got to it at the end, was that online scanners work fine as long as you can get online on the machine that you're having a problem with, which is one of the reasons that rescue disks are useful, is that the machine can no longer get online or you don't trust it to be online, so you want to scan while the main operating system's not running.
Okay, very good. Well, coming up later this month, we don't have any callers waiting for us, and we're here very near the end of the time that we have today on Focus to talk about computers. I did want to mention that, you know, Earth Day is coming up at the end of the month, April 22nd, and I did want to mention that there's another opportunity for area residents to recycle unwanted electronics for free, and that will be in Champaign on Saturday, May 21st from 8 a.m. until noon. And if you go to the Regional Plan Commission, Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, you can find all the details there. And no doubt on the next Computers in You program coming up May 5th, 2011, we'll mention that once again. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up? We're here at the end. No?
No, I don't think
so. All right. So will we see you in May or June?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Okay. I have to ask Peter or check the email.
All right.
Somebody will be here next month.
That's right. May 5th, somebody will be here to talk about computers on Focus. And our thanks this morning to Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick with Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services at the University of Illinois.